I want to take a moment to acknowledge that when we gather in this part of the world, this point in history, we gather on what is correctly known as Treaty 1 territory, and also in the homeland of the Métis Nation. And for my part, I am grateful to be able to live and work, and for this community to be able to explore what we believe right here. It's a gift. Let's take a few moments to breathe together. And I'm going to continue with that rhythm of four, in for a count of four, cradle your breath for a count of seven, exhale for a count of eight. I'm doing that because in this instance, I get to choose. And that's a rhythm that's been working really well for me, because I find that I actually cradle my breath deeper with that longer count and exhale more fully with the longer count, which helps me to really attend to my breath in. And attending to my breath in this day has been reminding me that when I breathe in, what I'm doing, among other things, is I am enacting what we all both desire and need all the time, and that is the ability to breathe freely and without fear. The metaphor of I'm choking, the literal experience of I'm choking, has come into our view powerfully this past year. And it's an important reminder anytime, and also when we're talking about things that have to do with race and race relations, like colonization does, that the ability to breathe freely and without fear is not a given. It can be oppressed, it can be taken away, but it is a shared human need and desire. And so perhaps with that in mind, let's take some time to breathe together. Let's do four rounds of this morning. If you're just popping in as a guest, or you're watching this at another time, or perhaps listening to it on the podcast, just two reminders. The first is that it's just an invitation, not an obligation, always in our context. And the other is that if you're listening to this on the podcast, I shorten the breathing time on the podcast, so it's not a long chunk of silence, but you can always just hit pause and breathe as long as you want or need to, and then resume. All right, let's breathe together, okay? Here we go. All right, peace, everybody. Let us carry on. I want to acknowledge a couple of things that feel significant to me as we get underway this morning. The first is that any kind of authentic exploration of what we believe is bound to take us into uncomfortable places. If it doesn't, I would say that the odds are at least fair that we're dodging the deep stuff, that we're sort of putting on our explorer face, but we're not actually going there. And that might sound a little bit masochistic, maybe reminiscent of sort of the old school approach to fitness that says, if you're not in pain, you're not making progress. No pain, no gain. I can still hear that one in my head. Some of us have been formed by spiritualities that take that same approach, except that they substitute guilt and shame for, you know, sore muscles. And that's a very different approach than one that is gentle and affirming. So if we stayed with that exercise analogy, for example, maybe that would be more along the lines as regards exercise of the everything counts sort of approach. Spiritualities that are more inclined to this approach might basically come down to ideas like, you're beautiful just the way you are, and so enough with the striving already. You know, just acknowledge the beauty. And what I want to say about exploring what we believe is that I think both of those illustrations point to something that has merit, and they also both leave something out, and we'll get to that in a moment. In order to expand or refine or reconsider what we believe, we're going to need some encouragement. I think that sort of almost goes without saying. And that's what's lovely about an analogy or an idea like everything counts. We can sort of strap on our metaphoric Fitbit and we can keep track of our steps, the majority of which we may have had to make anyway. But then we'll be encouraged by the way that they add up to something helpful. And I think that when it comes to exploring what we believe, maybe that's comparable to the realization that we're surrounded by people that are also exploring. We're not trying to lift a new idea or a perspective or a concept alone. We're not in this alone. Exploring what we believe can be part of everyday life. It doesn't have to be the equivalent of a trip to the gym or, you know, changing everything we're wearing, including our shoes, to go for a run. But what about that other idea? What about the one that says discomfort points to effort and there are some results that only come that way? Well, that's also true, right? Sometimes if we want to see deep change, we need to be willing to push further than might be comfortable. All that to say this. As we've worked our way into this series on decolonizing religion, I have been encouraged by and I have felt proud of this community's blending of those different kinds of perspectives. I've listened to people both encourage and challenge one another. I've listened to people work to find ways to say, you know what, when it comes to engaging ideas that are new to you or processing values that might be so embedded that they're invisible, every effort counts. And also, there are times when the necessary effort is really demanding and it's hard. Now, what's missing, I would say, from those two otherwise perhaps polarizing perspectives is complexity. We could use other words for it, but that's the word I'm going to choose. What I'm trying to capture with the word complexity here is the lived reality that neither no pain, no gain, nor it's all good adequately account for sort of the fluid and dynamic nature of learning and growing as people. Sometimes we need a push. Sometimes we need a rest. Sometimes we need a helping hand. Sometimes we need to sort something out on our own and so on, right? It's okay for learning new things to be complicated and even disconcerting. That's all right. It's also okay for there to be moments of just joyful discovery of the you know, light bulb going on for us and that kind of, oh, I never thought of it that way before. Not something we necessarily go to very readily, right? Because, especially with other people, maybe, because to go to an, oh, I never thought of it that way before is to say, we can feel like it's to confess some kind of an inadequacy, especially if the idea feels like an important and valuable one where it's just like, why didn't I think of that before? How could I have been so blind? Or am I not smart enough? Or how come everybody in this group seems to understand this? And I don't, like all those feelings of inadequacy and so on and so forth. So it can be an aha moment that's hard to acknowledge sometimes, right? Whole part of learning. Listen, we're not going to stay in this series forever. I have now said it out loud. We will not stay in this series forever. But when we leave it, it won't be because the work is done. And I think it's okay to acknowledge that. I feel as though when we leave it, it will be because feedback says, however we get there, there's some sense that that's enough of that to chew on for right now. And we just need some time to, you know, to ruminate, so to speak. But we're going to carry on for now. I want to pick up this morning where we left off in last week's talky bit, which was with an introduction to the work of Jeffrey S. Dennis. I'm not going to spend a bunch of time reintroducing him in his academic context. That info is in last week's talky bit and worth going back for if you're interested in that. But Dennis is writing about a relatively new idea in terms of the academic discourse about racism called laissez-faire racism. Now, I get that when I use a word like racism, that's enough to get some of our backs up. It's not a nice word. Isms in general can be very sweeping and difficult to handle well. So a little bit of context here. For me, that word in this context, this conversation in particular, it's a way of acknowledging a big, complex reality, which is that we live in a world where things like discrimination, oppression, and equality are everyday experiences, and that when those sorts of things are based on the idea that race is a fundamental determinant of human traits, and that some races are, based on those traits, superior to others, I think we can fairly call that racism. Now, with an understanding like that, we can see that racism isn't something that only some people groups might enact. It's something that anyone can be vulnerable to, both as a victim and as a perpetrator. That said, in this series, we've been primarily examining ways in which white European settlers used their understanding that their religious beliefs, their political and social structures, and their cultural values, and they themselves were all superior to whatever peoples and cultures they encountered, and that they used that understanding in exploitive ways. And in particular, we've been considering some of those impacts right here on this continent inside religion, especially inside of Christianity, since that's the religion of the colonizers and the one that's also most familiar to the majority of the people within this community. And we've also been looking at where those things might reside in ourselves, in our own insides, in our interior life. So in many ways, what I just described when I was talking about racism is what Jeffrey S. Dennis would call old-fashioned prejudice. He also calls it overt categorical hostility, as in, you know, I distrust, dislike, or even hate you simply based on your skin color or racial identity. I've had to think hard about this next sentence. I'm still wrestling with it a little bit. I believe it to be the case for me. I'm open to recalling something that would make it a not true statement. But what I wrote down was, I don't personally know anybody who wants to be that kind of racist. I'm aware that there are people that do. But I don't know anyone personally that does. And that doesn't make me a different category of human, other than fortunate, I suppose. But it does suggest something to me, which is that I think most of us humans would like to think that we're capable of doing better than that. We're capable of something much better than old-fashioned prejudice or overt categorical hostility. We might have even done enough homework, perhaps as recently as this past year, as part of being stirred by some of the dramatic events unfolding around us, to learn that race as a biological idea is nonsensical, because all humans share the same genetic makeup, and that the concept of race as a determinant for particular human traits similarly does not have a scientific foundation. And I don't think most of us would enact overt categorical hostility on the basis of race. So if that's our working definition of racist, then right, we're home free. You know, we can say, I'm not a racist, but I don't do those things. What Dennis's research reveals is that we're all surrounded by ordinary things, by ordinary human behaviors and by values that are common to all people that can contribute to the reinforcement of racist stereotypes and groupings, even among people who would think of themselves as clearly not racist and who might be motivated to undo the damage done by that sort of old-fashioned kind of racism. So the point, and I mean, it could sort of sound like, when you get into this, like, oh great, we didn't have an encompassing enough definition of racism, so let's make it bigger so we don't leave anybody out. And I want to say something about that, because the point of this kind of exploration is not to widen the net until everybody has to grovel, to sort of turn their face down in shame and acknowledge that in light of this new understanding, this new more broad sweeping understanding, they too are a racist. Generally speaking, that kind of response doesn't change much, except now we have a bunch of shame-filled people that still have misconceptions about racism and no new ideas about reconciliation or about moving the conversation forward, right? What Dennis is after is trying to help us all see the ordinary ways in which we might be part of the problem, even while thinking of ourselves as part of the solution. Something that he defines as laissez-faire racism, as distinct from that hostility we were just talking about a moment ago. And the reason for that kind of learning is not guilt. It's growth. It's so we can see where we might be stuck and continue to make progress, both on our own and together as human beings. So I think the intent of that kind of exploration is really important to making good use of it, to plugging it in well, not getting stuck at the kind of the guilt and shame, in the guilt and shame part of the experience. Anyway, let's unpack a couple of his ideas and just sort of see where that takes us. And I also want to say that there will be a couple points in unpacking this where I will use the word Indian. I will use it only quoting an Indigenous or First Nations source, and in each instance where I will use it, those are sources that I have spent time with and sources that have thoughtfully explained why they have chosen to use the word, as Indigenous or First Nations peoples, why they have chosen to use the word Indian. And I think it's fair to say in these cases, these particular cases, that it always points back to the way the word has been used. It's a way of reclaiming the word as sort of a lever in the conversation, rather than having it be a pejorative or a word that just has a nonsensical piece of history. So for instance, it would reference things like the Indian Act in terms of Canadian government enactment of colonizing attitudes and values. So just so you understand that, that's not my lane to make that choice. But as a white person in this conversation, I respectfully acknowledge that Indigenous writers and thinkers have sometimes made that choice, and their ideas are helpful to me, and I want to reference them as clearly as I can. So, Dennis's central idea in both his article and his book is that getting differing people groups to live and work more closely together will resolve the effects of racism doesn't work. So we would kind of might think that that's sort of logical, right? Like if we just take these different groups of people that have been overtly hostile to one another, or prejudiced against one another, or that there's been prejudice flowing in one direction, even if we just get them together, if we just bring them into proximity with one another, they live and work together, that's going to undo the impacts of racism and of colonization. And that's not a bad idea, of course. We do need to learn how to live well together. We need to learn how to work well together with folks that we don't perceive as being like us. It's the resolve the effects of racism part where this fails, where it doesn't work. And here's Dennis's take on why that is the case. And this is sort of what I found most helpful about this conversation as someone coming from my sort of cultural vantage point. Dennis points to laissez-faire racism as something that emerged after the movement led by Martin Luther King. So at a point in history on this continent where it became less tenable to be overtly hostile on the basis of race. So some progress was made in that regard in that movement. We're not going to get into it today, but I would say that there are some interesting parallels between that period and the one that we're in right now. Of course, lots of people pointing that out. Not the least of which is that there is a groundswell of support for racial equality. Now, under those kinds of cultural conditions, overtly hostile expressions of racism might, broadly speaking, be in retreat. They're being reduced by social pressure, among other things. The overall populace might feel pressure to not express racist ideas or use racist speech and so on. It wasn't that long ago that you could be overtly racist in the workplace and that people would roll their eyes or maybe they'd laugh if they agreed or whatever. Now you send the wrong tweet and you land to no job. It's a different environment around these kinds of things, right? All of which, that pressure to not express those things, all of that may or may not actually change what people believe internally. May not, the fact that we express less overt hostility or less old-fashioned prejudice does not necessarily mean we have less of it. And that's important in this. So, as ancient wisdom has long pointed out, it's out of what is in what the Hebrew poets would have called our heart, what we might in this period call our self. It's out of that place that our actions flow. So when it comes to resolving the effects of things like discrimination and oppression, it's what flows out that ultimately kind of gets enacted. But that comes from somewhere. So starting with the positive assumption that those of us listening do not wish to oppress or exploit others for any reason, including reasons such as concepts like race, what are some ordinary human ways of being and interacting that might still pull us into enacting something other than our best intentions? We're not setting out to exploit. We're not setting out to oppress. In fact, we would like to enact the opposite of those things. We would like to enact greater freedom, greater equality, and so on. But are there some sand traps on this one? Are there some things along the way that are just, we're used to them being there, that could kind of pull us off course in that? And Dennis contends that his research points to three social processes that keep this laissez-faire, this kind of interwoven, everyday, built-in racism going. They've got fancy names, but in the end, they're all ordinary things that we can all readily see and I think fairly readily understand as well. And the first is something that he calls subtyping. Subtyping is when we have a stereotypical image of a certain people group, and when we see someone from that group doing really well, we explain it by regarding them as the exception to the rule. To reference an increasingly painful and uncomfortable memory for me growing up, and to use the in some ways horrible language that often went with it, those Indians are all, they're all lazy. Indians are lazy people. That's a race trait, would be the understanding behind a horrific sentence like that, right? That you arrive in the world because of your genetics with this predisposition. Again, an idea that's been put paid long since by science, but this still exists in the culture. So if you have a stereotype like that, all right, and you see a First Nations person that's doing well because they have an extensive education, let's say, then you might regard them as exceptional because they have that education. So the reason they're doing so well as a, and this is where I'm going to use that word Indian again, the reason they're doing so well as an Indian is because they are the exception. They are an educated Indian, right? Or maybe we see a First Nations person who's doing well financially. Maybe they're running a thriving business, and we might regard them as exceptional because they have more wealth. You know, they're doing well because they're a rich Indian, right? It's the wealth that's the key to this whole thing. And the problem is that we're seeing these people as exceptions to the rule rather than as examples of why the stereotype shouldn't exist in the first place, why the stereotype is nonsense in the first place. The problem is with the rule. So that's subtyping. And the second social process that Dennis writes about is one called ideology-based homophily. Ideology-based homophily. That's a bit of a mouthful, but it's also the sort of phrase that breaks down into a helpful definition of something that most of us do every day. So let's take the phrase in reverse. First of all, what's homophily? Homophily is when we as humans want to be around and make friendships with people who are like us. Well, duh. You know, this is easy to see, and perhaps easiest to see when we're not in the thick of it, like lots of things. So let's consider age-based homophily. So you watch kids in a group, and they tend to sort of self-sort, right? A little bit if it's a big enough group, and we tend to make friends with people that are of a similar age or at a similar stage that we're at. That's just sort of a normal human behavior. And the same thing shows up when it comes to things like shared interests and so on. So that's pretty much just part of how we're wired. Ideology-based homophily is when we make friends with people who think like we do, who have the same ideology we do, who have similar kind of wider paradigms or worldviews to ours. And we know what this is like, right? We know it feels great to hang out with people who share our perspectives. Who doesn't want that? You know, Zuckerberg has gotten unimaginably wealthy, for example, based on that human trait. When it can get in the way of something like addressing the deep-seated impacts of colonialism is when we start to learn about this stuff and it begins to shift our understandings, but not everyone in our ideologically based homophily group is on that path. When our ideology starts to shift, we're still in the same group. So the same thing can be true about exploring almost anything we believe, right? There are lots of people in this community, and I know this from the conversations I've had and the stories I've heard, who know what it feels like to find themselves either feeling like they're no longer at ease in a group that once felt like home, or that they're no longer made welcome in such a group because some evolving part of their worldview no longer matches the ideology-based homophily of the group. And I could tell this story personally and illustrate it, you know, from several stories. I am not being the least bit melodramatic when I say if you start to take decolonizing what you believe about things like race and religion seriously, and those shifts start to show up in your worldview and how you express it, brace yourself for some social shifts. If that's not an experience you've had already. This is assuming, of course, that the things we're learning as we explore shift us at a different pace or in a different direction than the group. And sometimes we have the comforting experience of an entire group sort of working through something together and making a shift together. I would say that's the exception, but it's not unheard of course. One more social process idea from Dennis, and then we'll wrap this up for today. The last social process that Dennis points to as sort of an ordinary thing that can kind of keep us engaged in practicing something that he would call laissez-faire racism even when we don't mean to do it, if you will. The last one is something that he calls political avoidance norms. This one would take a lot to unpack deeply, but at a fairly sort of first pass level, here's a short version. This is a fancy phrase for what we do when we divide groups, in the case of this conversation that we're having, First Nations peoples, into two categories. people who speak up about things like the problems that history reveals or the rights of the group that are being violated or what needs to change, what Indigenous author Thomas King carefully and advisedly called the inconvenient Indians. And so that's one group. And then the other group is those that just kind of keep their head down and they quietly go about their lives. That kind of keeping your head down and going about your life, that plays directly into a social process called group theory, under which we tend to keep the privileged people privileged and maintain the status quo. So when people pick their head up and go, this isn't right, and I'm going to speak about it, things need to change, and I'm going to push for that change. If that push is on the privileged, and I'm not going to speak for you here, but in a lot of cases, that'd be me, then what political avoidance norms do is they allow me to point to that person and say, you are a troublemaker. You should just put your head back down and quietly live your life. And this will sort itself out. Let's just live together and this will sort itself out. How's that working out? Ask an oppressed person. This is something that doesn't just happen in conversations around things like decolonizing or race in general. It just happens in groups in general. And once we start to watch for it, we realize that there are norms for where we are and are not allowed to have productive conversations about whatever's contentious. And that would include things like race or issues that are race related. But it also includes whatever sort of ruffles the feathers of the others in the group. I don't know if you've ever had this experience. I know I have, and maybe it's just because my social radar is not very good, but where you bring up an issue or you articulate a perspective only to have the room sort of go quiet, or else somebody kind of makes a joke and the conversation kind of bounces off in another direction, or you just feel like it hit a slippery surface, it hit Teflon and it just sort of slid along for a ways and then it just kind of disappeared. The odds are fair that if we're having an experience like that, we've bumped into something that could be understood or named as a political avoidance norm. We've bumped into an unarticulated but real don't talk rule within that group or social setting. So those are examples of the kinds of social processes that might not look or sound like our classic definitions of racism or overt hostility, but they still serve to maintain harmful stereotypes and to keep us from digging into systems that need to change if we want to see and be part of transformative change in the world. Now, from where I sit, and I've been kind of studying this, you know, week over week, even from that vantage point, that feels like a little bit of a whirlwind tour. But it's where I'm going to leave it for now. I'm going to wrap this up by circling back to some ancient wisdom about human behavior in general that I think might apply well in this instance. There's an ancient Hebrew proverb that says, as water reflects the face, so one's life reflects the heart, or as we mentioned earlier, the self. If we feel like we can look at the world and see that something is wrong with it, and that something isn't changing, then the sages, the keepers of ancient wisdom, would say, look to the heart, look to the self. Look at what you and those around you, so this is where the self becomes bigger than the radical individual, right? Look at what you and those around you in your homophiles. Look at what you and those around you believe in the silent interior spaces of your life. The spaces where you can believe whatever you want without external judgment or censure. And see what's in there. Because what's in there is what you're going to seek group reinforcement for, and it's what's going to eventually come out one way or another. I don't think the sages were trying to be threatening when they wrote things like that. I really don't. I've heard, you know, in far too many religious settings in particular, I've heard those kind of ideas sort of used like a Santa Claus meets the Grim Reaper kind of scenario for God. You know, like God can see what's in your heart. He knows if you've been naughty or nice. And by the way, you know, he can kill you forever if you're naughty. So I don't think that's sort of the space the sages were in. I don't think that's the way wisdom operates, because wisdom understands that the only way we make progress on these things is by practice, that it's about lived experience. I think the sages were pointing to the same kinds of ideas those social theories are on about, that there are all sorts of ways that we've learned to keep the surface of things looking good, or at least keeping the rules, socially speaking. But if the inside is a mess, then the ugly stuff is going to keep getting dumped somewhere on someone, typically on whoever is the most vulnerable, and the world isn't going to get better. I think that if we want to be justified in thinking well of ourselves in this wider matter of decolonizing what we believe and how we act, and much more importantly, if we want to be part of the solution and not the problem, then just putting our heads down and sticking with the people that already think like we do about things that need to change but aren't changing really might not cut it. We might need to, with some help, some support, some encouragement, we might need to push a little further into the deep stuff. I think that's an idea that's worth exploring.